world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Aura Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
There's a London neighborhood called Canary Wharf, filled with glass and steel buildings, which in turn used to be filled with white-collar workers. How it's changing in a work-from-home, post-pandemic world could be a model for many other cities.
And when we were locked up at home during the pandemic, cinemas took a big hit, and not all of them survived. For those who have begun heading back to the movies, they're opting for really big, big screens, reclining seats, and a much fancier experience. But first.
So you've never been to a real school before?
Shut up.
Shut up!
I didn't say anything.
America has fretted about academic standards at its public schools since way before Mean Girls came out in 2004.
I'm kind of psychic.
Really?
It's like I have ESPN or something.
The Department of Education tried to avert a decline in school achievement back in 1983. That's around the same time that another popular film hit cinemas. This one about a group of misfits in detention.
A brain, a beauty, a jock, a rebel, and a recluse. The Breakfast Club.
Many states raised graduation requirements and began to introduce more comprehensive curricula. Some started requiring graduates to pass standardized English and maths tests. But recent trends suggest that these standards may have slipped once again.
More and more students are finishing high school. In the past 15 years, graduation rates at American high schools have increased from 74% to 87% on average.
Doug Dowson is a data journalist for The Economist.
Students are taking more courses and earning higher grades. But an analysis conducted by The Economist finds that these positive figures may be obscuring other more worrying trends.
What trends are you talking about here? Because isn't a higher graduation rate a positive indicator?
Normally, yes, but not when other measures of academic achievement are moving in the opposite direction. So, for example, scores on college admissions exams, such as the SAT or the ACT, are at historic lows. Results from the latest PISA, which is an international test run by the OECD, show that maths and reading literacy are flat or down. Scores on the NAEP, sometimes called the nation's report card, are also basically flat. And this disconnect is worrying because it suggests that schools may be lowering their academic standards in order to boost graduation rates.
So there's a higher graduation rate, but standards have been getting lower. Are they getting worse?
So to answer this, The Economist assembled data on graduation rates and standardized test scores at 3,000 high schools across six states for school years from 2007 to 2022. And we found that four-year graduation rates in our sample increased during this period, even as test scores fell. And the gains in graduation rates were greatest in high schools with the lowest test scores. So just for example, in 2007, schools with test scores in the bottom 10th of our sample graduated half of their students. But then in 2022, they graduated two-thirds. So as low-performing schools have passed more of their students, the relationship between test scores and graduation rates has weakened.
And how do you measure just how bad this is?
Right. So to quantify this, we ran an analysis of graduation rates at the school level that controlled for a lot of the important variables, test scores, dropout rates, and the actual year that we're observing. And we found that graduation rates went up even after controlling for changes in test scores and dropout rates. So that means that high schools are graduating more students than they would have in the past. Although our results differed from state to state, we found that, on average, American public high schools in our sample are inflating graduation rates by about 4 percentage points compared with 15 years ago.
And why has this happened?
The trend towards weakening standards can be blamed in part on No Child Left Behind. So this was the education reform law that was passed in 2002. This law required states to track the share of students that graduated on time and set annual targets for improvement. So this was a good idea in principle. The problem was that in practice, schools sort of set these targets and then did whatever they could to achieve those targets, even lowering academic standards. Another issue is concerns about racial equity. When New Jersey recently debated setting new benchmarks for its standardized tests, some folks on the board argued that higher standards would be unfair to Black and Latino students. You could also see this in Oregon in its latest decision to drop its graduation exams, which happened in November. This decision was based in part on a report by the Education Department, which found that the test produced inequitable outcomes for historically marginalized groups. So obviously, these concerns about equity are on the minds of policymakers.
And are America's policymakers looking to fix this creep in graduation rates?
No, not so much. You can just look at the recent news and you can see this isn't the case. In May of last year, New Jersey's Board of Education voted to lower the passing scores on its high school graduation test. In November, Oregon decided to scrap its graduation exams. And what's most worrying is that these policies to lower the bar are intended to narrow achievement gaps, but they may actually have the opposite effect.
What do you mean by that?
So a really interesting study from last year found that after schools in North Carolina introduced a new grading policy a few years ago that made it easier to earn A's and harder to earn F's, students with low test scores started to show up less often and put in less effort. And while the policy led to higher graduation rates, it also contributed to wider gaps in GPAs and test scores between the highest and the lowest scoring students. This all suggests that some of these policies aimed at lowering the bar may actually harm the very students they're meant to help.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ari.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
In 1988, Britain's then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher helped to sink the first pile in the redevelopment of London's Docklands.
With some last-minute adjustments to her headgear, the Prime Minister prepared to launch the construction of Canary Wharf. She took the controls of a 25-ton pile driver on the 71-acre site. Unfortunately, these machines don't have provision for storing handbags.
A derelict wasteland was to be transformed into the city's new financial hub.
Within the next 5 years, the area will become a vast development, housing two major foreign banks.
One part of it, Canary Wharf, was filled with bankers and lawyers, its glass towers a monument to Mrs. Thatcher's free market revolution. But these days, Londoners aren't commuting 5 days a week, and like similar districts around the world, Canary Wharf is having to adapt.
More of us are working from home. And like many business districts, this means that offices in Canary Wharf in London are emptier than they used to be.
Benjiru Nkandawire is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
That's a problem for commercial property landlords, and across London, just under a tenth of all office space is empty.
So is that to say that places like Canary Wharf that are office space first and foremost are falling on hard times?
Not necessarily. Canary Wharf's investors are so far pretty unruffled. Canary Wharf has fallen on hard times before. In the 1990s, it crashed into bankruptcy under its previous owners. And in 2008, the fall of the American investment bank Lehman Brothers cleared more than 76,000 square meters of office space overnight. In fact, the investors, Brookfield and the Qatar Investment Authority, injected around £400 million into the district last year. So they're sticking with their investment and their focus on reinventing it. I went down there last month to check it out. I met up with Safina Mirza, who is the Director of Communications at Canary Wharf Group.
So we were talking about all of the new constructions and you were showing me all the different buildings.
Yeah, and so what you can see in front of us is our residential program. So you can see a building on that side, buildings straight in front of you, building there, building there, building there. It's all Canary Wharf Group. 75% of what we're constructing is residential. And the remaining 20...
Housing plays a big part in Canary Wharf's transformation. Nearly all new building on the estate is earmarked for rental homes. And the plans mirror Brookfield's playbook elsewhere. In Manhattan West and Hudson Yards in New York, they own a string of offices, hotels, shops, and housing which sit side by side. So today, around 3,500 people live in Canary Wharf, and the first residents moved there in January 2020. And as well as housing, Canary Wharf has added fun activities like go-karting, outdoor sports screenings, and concerts in the summer, and even a beach volleyball tournament. At lunchtime, you get lots of people playing paddle. That's a crossover between tennis and squash, and I got to see it in action. The water surrounding the former docks is now used for swimming, boat rentals, and 5 kilometers of boardwalks. So along the river, you get lots of dog walkers, parents pushing prams and joggers, and they even turned a vacant car park into a huge indoor playground with a roller rink, ball pits, and bumper cars.
Now, Vinjero, I have walked along those boardwalks. I have gone to some of those outdoor screenings. I live just across the river from Canary Wharf, but I have to say it's still an area that feels dominated by those big office building skyscrapers. And as you say, plenty of those are still empty.
Yes, well, offices are still at the core of Canary Wharf, but their importance has shrunk. Offices used to be around 95% of the portfolio's value 20 years ago, but now they're closer to 74%. And Canary Wharf also has plans for a life sciences campus, so you'll get more medtech and biotech professionals working in the district. And the result of all of this is hopefully a mix of assets that should be more resilient to fluctuations in demand for any single class of property. And offices haven't completely been forgotten. Citigroup is spending over £100 million to refurbish its building, and Barclays has revamped its office tower. It's added brand new trading floors with a cafe selling mocktails and coq au vin.
So we should see what's going on in Canary Wharf as a sort of urban planning success.
It's certainly paying off. Around 6.3 million people visited the estate in January. That's up 8% year on year. Midweek trips have returned to pre-pandemic levels, and evening visits are up by half. They've nearly doubled the number of bars, cafes, and restaurants on the estate as well, and the Waitrose supermarket in Canary Wharf is the best-performing branch in Britain. So Canary Wharf's strategy is working.
And presumably, when this kind of trend is going on in lots of cities around the world, maybe there's a model here to be learned from, to be copied.
I think so, because many cities are still recovering from the effects of lockdowns, and Canary Wharf demonstrates the jarring disconnect that's emerged between urban centers that are simply muddling through and those that are thriving. Places like Singapore and Tokyo haven't fully recovered to their pre-pandemic levels of tourism, for example, whereas London has bounced back and New York City is almost there. I think the biggest lesson from Canary Wharf is the importance of diversifying the property mix, and that mirrors what's happening in cities around the world. Some cities are adding more green space and cycle lanes. Some are banning cars completely from parts of the city. Paris is cleaning up the River Seine for the Olympics, and New York and Singapore are looking at converting offices to apartments. So there are lots of important lessons you could take away from Canary Wharf's transformation.
Thanks very much for your time, Vinjo.
Thanks for having me.
cinemas have what looks like a bad case of long COVID.
Tom Wainwright is The Economist's media editor.
They had a terrible time, not surprisingly, during the pandemic and during lockdowns. But even now, they're nowhere near where they were before the pandemic. Last year, the global box office was about a quarter below its pre-pandemic figure. And it seems as if people have just got out of the habit of going to the movies. Back in 2000, the average American went a bit more than five times a year. Last year, the average American probably went fewer than three times. People these days are spending more time at home, more time with their streaming services, and this, not surprisingly, has been terrible for cinema chains. We've seen chains like Cineworld, which is the world's second largest, go into administration. So, difficult times for the movie industry. There's one big exception to this, and the big exception actually is the biggest screens of all. We've seen this recently with IMAX, which makes those gigantic screens up to 38 metres wide. Last year, it took $1.1 billion at the box office, which was the second highest total in its history, and it had actually its biggest ever haul in the domestic box office, which is America and Canada. They announced their annual results recently, and they said that their annual revenue was up by a quarter. And this year, they expect to install up to 150 new screens. This is at a time, of course, when most other cinemas are more likely to be closing than opening, so a big exception here. I think this is part of a bigger trend, really, in cinema. What seems to be happening is that people are no longer treating a trip to the theatre as something that you do as frequently as before, but as it becomes less frequent, it's turning into more of a kind of treat. People are going less often, and when they do go, they really want to make a big night of it. So they go to the biggest screen they can find, they go to somewhere that makes it more of a sort of event. And we're seeing trends where cinema chains are introducing things like heated reclining seats and waiter service so you can order a cocktail to be brought to your seat, making it more of a special night out. And we see this reflected a bit in prices. So the average price paid for a ticket last year to see a film in the States was $10.50, and that's up from about $9 just before the pandemic. And we've seen other chains as well benefiting from this. It's not just IMAX. In South Korea, for example, there's a chain called CGV, and they have rebranded their multiplexes as cultureplexes. So they're no longer just places where you go to catch a film. You can also attend live music events. They do gaming, they do dining, drinking, the whole range of stuff. And they've upgraded their auditoriums in a big way too. So they now have wind and rain and smells that you can experience, and I'm not sure this is something I'd necessarily pay more for, but it seems some people do. There's another example, a chain in the UAE called Vox. In one of their branches, they serve Wagyu beef wrapped in gold leaf, for which they charge $119. So again, it's not just your typical weekly trip to the movies anymore. This is a kind of two or three times a year blowout where you catch the film, but you also have drinks, you have dinner, and it's more of a special night out. The movie business overall is still finding things very difficult, and this year is going to be tough. Last year, box office takings were still lower than they were before the pandemic, and actually most analysts think that this year's takings are going to be lower even than they were last year. A big reason for that is the strikes that we saw last year in Hollywood, which have delayed some big releases. There were sequels to Mission Impossible and Avatar, which I think originally were due to come out this year, probably not going to come out this year anymore, so takings this year are going to be lower. And I think the cinemas that do best are going to be those that treat a trip to the movies like the kind of rare luxury that it is fast becoming.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We've made a few changes to our podcasts lately, and we're eager to hear what you think, particularly if you listen to The Intelligence and have yet to subscribe to our new premium service, Economist Podcasts Plus. If you'd like to share your thoughts, just click the link in the show notes. And thanks. Your feedback means a lot to us. See you back here tomorrow.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.